Welcome to The Next Level. I'm JVL here with my best friends, Sarah Longwell and Timothy Miller of The Bulwark. This is the first time out from behind the paywall. The podcast is now being made for you, the people. We're gonna
mass communicating.
Something like that. So listen, two things. First of all, mash the subscribe button and also go over to thebulwark.com and sign up for all the great stuff. We do stuff over there every day. We have stories and podcasts and videos and it's almost all free. So you should go over and join us at thebulwark.com. Sarah, Tim, how are you guys today?
Do you want to do any like preamble about the fact that this is a podcast that we have done behind the paywall now for like a year at least, right?
It feels longer. I don't know how long.
I think it's been 7 years actually, yeah. Sarah.
Okay. Boy. And so it is liberated from the paywall for the first time. Did you guys see the new cover art? It's our faces.
Oh God.
Yes, it is. That's exactly how there? You should feel about
they have,
it.
They have me doing Blue Steel. It's outstanding.
It was like when they did the Not My Party logo without asking me for approval. And I was like, the devil? I have like devil ears that's going up. I really didn't
Don't
like
be
it.
Don't be a prima donna. I'm
a prima donna. I can Don't be a difficult. Little bit of a prima donna. Can I not?
My staff has so much respect for me. I was like, absolutely not. Just went ahead. Absolutely not that picture of my face.
You know what? This is a chance for you to, Sarah, lead by example and by showing that you don't care about such trivialities, to then make it so that everybody else in the organization also feels like they can't care about trivialities.
That's true. I mean, I didn't really put up a fight. I was just like, all right, whatever.
Yep. Exactly. All right. Well, so,
but the magic has been happening. I think the important thing to understand for the new listeners is that I like to interrupt, and that this magic that you're hearing right now has been happening now for many, many years. And the people have been demanding it. The people have been demanding that we bring this public. Mostly the people on Sarah's paid staff have been demanding that we bring this public. They're of the opinion that this is now going to be, I don't know, up there with maybe Michael Barbaro in the Daily, or who knows right now, the heights that we could reach. So please share it with, you know, your most bulwarky friend.
Whatever level it is, it's the next one.
Ooh.
All right, let's go here. We're taping on Tuesday afternoon. We were supposed to have the final January 6th committee hearing on Wednesday. That is now going to be postponed because there is a hurricane which is heading directly towards Florida. It's amazing. All of these models do not show a little bulbous thing where it could possibly veer off into Alabama or something. They just show a normal track. It's wonderful to live in a world where that happens. So I don't want to spend too much time on the January 6th thing, but Tim, there is some new footage of Roger Stone out from the documentary. Will you take this away so we can talk about it for 2 minutes?
Yeah. Are we listening to it? Should we listen to Raj? It's quite good. I mean, it's quite, you won't be surprised.
All you have to do is ask. You simply ask it.
Yeah. Okay.
And the producers will make it appear.
Yeah, we'll get to it. You will not be surprised. There's a little preview for this to hear Roger. And this is not deep, eloquent thinking about the values of nationalist populism. Okay. That you're not getting the Claremont review here. It's a little rough talk. So let's just, just go ahead and check it out.
Excellent. the violence. The voting. Let's get right to the violence.
Get right to it.
Shoot to kill. See an Antifa? Shoot to kill. Yeah, done with this bullshit.
Shoot to kill. Now, I don't. That doesn't. That doesn't sound like just people who have legitimate concerns about our election security to me, especially given that that audio was from before the election. Actually, this audio is from before the election. So they hadn't even come up with the reason why, the Hugo Chavez had broken into our election machines yet. Yeah, my top thoughts on this is just the hubris of these fucking guys. Like, this is now the second documentary film crew that we had following these people around. The Alex Holder film crew that was following around the Trumps that the January 6th committee got. Now we have this. This is a Danish film guy. Imagine being Roger Stone and feeling so above the law, knowing that Donald Trump will pardon you, that you can just kind of pal around with Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and just, you know, chat about shooting to kill, chat about undermining the election, the plans to violently overthrow our democracy, and be like, yeah, you know, we can let the Danes get this baby on tape.
Tim, why are you so obsessed with Trump? Why won't you just move on?
That's a good question.
It's like he broke your brain or something.
I do feel broken.
Right? Why can't you just plan for the post-Trump Republican future?
Is Roger going to be involved in that?
Sarah, thoughts?
I mean, Roger's a bad person. And wait, Tim, just to go back, where was this? Like, what was the context under which he was saying this?
He's hanging out with a bunch of Proud Boys.
Yeah, he's in a car. They're driving in the car, hanging out with a bunch of Proud Boys. And a Danish filmmaker is covering, is following their efforts. The election hasn't happened yet, but they're talking about how they shouldn't wait for the, why wait for the votes? You know, don't even need to wait for the votes.
Let's just get to the violence.
Let's just get to the violence, yeah.
So there's also a second piece of audio with him with another group of Proud Boys in which Roger Stone is saying that it was important that Trump just come out and declare that he's won because, you know, the votes might not show that, but possession is 9/10 of the law and make them try to take it from him. Yeah. And, you know, Sarah, what do you think about all this? This is great for democracy. It's totally cool, right?
So this isn't the only time where somebody has said, like, what Trump should do is just come out and declare victory. Somebody Bannon. Else said it. Like, Bannon, right? So like in the bowels of Trump's, what are actually his quite close advisors, Roger Stone, Steve Bannon, the people who've surrounded him, there was this sort of premeditated theory that even if he loses, he's going to come out and declare victory. What's interesting about the Roger Stone piece is the violence part where they seemed ready, right, to have the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers show up and cause violence and mayhem. And so it doesn't surprise me that the January 6th committee would want to highlight the fact that there was this, you know, group of people. When you think about, too, sort of the aftermath of it all, it's so brazen. These guys are out there on film talking about their premeditated violence, their premeditated desire to say that the election, that Trump should just declare victory no matter what. And yet they still had the audacity when it all went down to be like, that was Antifa. Let's look at those Black Lives Matter guys. It's attacking the Capitol under false flags to make us Republicans look bad. You know, and this really is where the bifurcated media gives such an advantage to all of these like lunatics, because it's like hard to actually piece it all together, or like you piece it all together a year later. We hear this and it should be smoking gun kind of territory, right? Like, these guys were planning the violence. They were planning to declare victory. It all happened just like they were planning it to happen. And yet we're all like, yeah, Roger Stone's a lunatic. That tracks.
Well, this shows to me, this is like following an EPA investigation on a toxic leak in a river, right? So you start with this.
Who's the river?
The river is the Republican Party. So you have this stuff at the source. We have Roger Stone asking for violence and saying, we're just going to declare it. And then it moves downriver into the Kerry Lake parts of the world where everybody just takes as given that, of course, the election was stolen. We need to jail the people who were counting the votes because they, you know, locked them up because the Secretary of State should never have certified this stolen election. Then you get Glenn Youngkin running out to Arizona. Mr. Good Republican, Mr. Youngkin model, Mr. The Future, Mr. You got to like Trump a little bit if you're going to eventually not like Trump at all. And you have him out there and, you know, it is like 3 degrees of Steve Bannon or something. And you wind up.
Did you intentionally do this metaphor so that the river landed into the Kerry Lake?
Yes.
Versus the Doug Mastriano? Yes, I did. You know, that worked for me.
My brain works on multiple levels, Timothy.
That worked for me. So the question I think going to this is the metaphor is like, is it Stone that is at the core of this, right? Or to the extent, how close is Trump to it? And we don't want to beat the metaphor to death, right? But for a long time now, and this is the same exact thing that happened in the Mueller investigation with Russia, right? It's this notion that Trump is too stupid to have plotted this. Like, Trump isn't actually doing this, right? Like, you know, he is hoping it happens and rooting for it, right? He's rooting for Russia to attack Hillary. He's rooting for these people who are charging the Capitol, but he's not really plotting it. He's not really doing it, right? This is your, I don't know where this is along our river, somewhere between Lake and Youngkin's argument for what's happening. But it's the same guy in both situations. It was Roger Stone that's talking to Assange. It's Roger Stone that's plotting with the people that were the active participants in the insurrection, that were spurring on, the great and good Americans, the fine people who just showed up that day to cheer on the president and ended up finding themselves in the Capitol. Like, the people that were actively plotting, it was Stone with them. And, like, are we sure that Trump and Stone aren't talking ever?
I'm sure they are talking.
Yeah, so this is where the January 6th committee stuff, like, remains still relevant, right? And I think where the investigative portion of the January 6th committee, whenever they come back in, like, that element matters, right? The extent to which, you know, Trump is not just talking with Meadows, not just throwing a temper tantrum, not just having a speech, not just pressuring the Secretary of State. I mean, he's guilty, guilty, guilty across the board on all that. But like, how much he's actually also talking to the violent rioters.
Well, but this is how racketeering works, right? I mean, you know, skinny Joey Merlino at the top of the organization does not know every
single
shake.
Is that a real person? You just make that up on the fly.
That's a real person. Philly Mob Stories. He does not know every single business that, you know, Mikey Knuckles is shaking down on a daily basis.
Is Mikey Knuckles a
real
person?
Because he just knows that Mikey Knuckles is doing, you know, Mikey Knuckles is doing what he's got to do and doing his job. And this is, you know, so there are things which I'm sure Trump knew, things which Trump wanted to, you know, to instigate, things which he wanted to have plausible deniability about. You saw this in the Maggie Haberman clip, right? Maggie Haberman had an excerpt from her book on in the Atlantic this weekend. And, you know, like, there was a moment in it where Trump is talking about Sidney Powell and Sidney Powell's defense against the Dominion lawsuits being that she shouldn't have been taken seriously. And he thought that was weak. And he had, like, the legal primer ready for that. And, you know, I forget the exact phrase, but, he, you know, there's a legal term of art. He said, all you have to say is that to the best of my knowledge and understanding that these things were true.
He understands how difficult it is to prove intent.
Yeah.
And that proving intent requires, like, proof of forethought or, like, an understanding of what you're doing. And he seemed to have that particular legal loophole. Or not legal, it's not a loophole, but it's like,
yeah,
he understood, yeah, how you get around that.
All right, so we'll get the final January 6th hearing at some point.
Before we move on to the next category, I'm sorry, but I've just received something in my Slack that I think that it's worth discussing, which is the new Next Level imagery. And
I also received that in my Slack. We look a bit,
I know, but I hadn't actually seen it yet.
Wouldn't you say? Okay?
And now I'm looking at JVL and I think that if you said to an average viewer that there are two gay people on this picture and only one heterosexual, I don't know how many people would not choose you. I mean, you have a very kind of effeminate magician vibe. On the new artwork.
I'm Gob Bluth in this.
Gob Bluth, you do. You can, I guess
the
Gob
final
is straight,
countdown
you,
on, and I'm gonna. No, yeah. Gob is not straight. You, that's the great joke of that. Gob goes blue for Ben Stiller's character in the, like, the fourth and fifth, the Netflix seasons of Arrested Development. Gob and Ben Stiller's Tony Wonder become a couple.
Oh, really? I never made it to season 5. That you kind of do. It is a Gob. This is gay Gob. This is right. It's. I think that's the vibe you're giving off.
It's great. I'm about to do the Sword of Destiny routine. All right, let's move on.
Hold on. You guys are missing the main point of this artwork, which is that we all look like corpses.
Yeah, well, there, like, needs to be some color adjustment.
Forget gay.
There
we all
be
look
some
dead.
Color adjustment.
It's been a long few years, though, so I get it. I get the vibe that they're trying to send, which is these people have been beaten down by the Trump years, and they're here to report from the grave.
We're going to try to go to another level above where they are now. All right. So listen, I want to talk midterms. I want to talk about both Ohio and Pennsylvania because there are two interesting things happening. in Ohio. So we talked, I think it was last week, about the Kemp Warnock voters, right? It was on our Not Quite Yet Out From Behind the Paywall show, how there were a whole bunch of people in Georgia who were going to vote for Brian Kemp for governor, and then we're going to vote for Raphael Warnock for senator. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more people like that in Ohio, where Mike DeWine is up by 23 points. He's at 55%. And Tim Ryan is at 46%, leading J.D. Vance by 3 points, which means that even if you don't believe the polls, even if you believe that the Ryan-Vance race is closer than it looks, or that Vance is ahead a little bit, it means that they're like one in 10 DeWine voters is voting for Tim Ryan. That's nuts.
Well,
people in Ohio don't like J.D. Vance.
Yeah, it's not nuts when you think that Sherrod Brown won in 2018 by 6 points. Like, Trump won in 2020 by 8, Sherrod Brown won in 18 by 6, which means that, and I've said this about Ohio, and if you listen to the focus group episode we did in Ohio, we talked to a bunch of Trump 2020 voters and Sherrod Brown 18 voters. And they were mostly going for Ryan. And the reason was, and actually it was pretty interesting. One of the main things was they did not like Vance. They did not trust Vance. But also Ryan had been on the airwaves mostly unopposed over the summer. And he'd landed a couple of doozies. And one of them, so first of all, he's running an excellent campaign.
Really?
Just a tremendous door knocking, I'm your neighbor, like, I'm from here.
He's a good candidate, too. He's a good candidate running a great campaign.
And just really quick on the ads, not, and a shamelessly good kind of the stuff you have to do that we're always asking Democrats to do. Like, he was running ads that had Tucker Carlson praising him.
Yeah.
Right? There are a lot of Democratic staffers who are like, ooh, they get a little, that makes them feel a little uncomfortable, a little queasy. They won't go there. Like, he's going there.
He's touting that he voted with Trump on trade. He says he will vote, he'll vote with whichever political party isn't going to outsource their jobs, the jobs of his friends and neighbors. He's got a great one where he's walking through his neighborhood and he's saying, like, I think about these people every single time I vote. Like, it's really good. But one of the ads that everybody remembered and talked about in this group was that he was nailing Vance on the fact that he had a scam opioid charity. So he had this charity where he was supposedly collecting money to give to opioid, recovery services, and $0. Like, for some reason, it did some polls, this group. And I didn't really know about this, but the women were talking about it in the group and about how they went and ran it down and looked it up. And they were like, and it's true and it's terrible. So I would say he's done a good job of driving up Vance's negatives over the summer in a way where, look, I still think Republicans come home. I think overall, generally, I have a theory of Republicans coming home at the end. But I don't know. This is one of the craziest races where I think he does have a puncher's chance. And in part, just because, you know, campaigns matter and candidates matter.
Yeah. And I do think in Ohio, the one polling caution before I kind of get into the good news is, like, the types of voters that these polls have seemed to be missing are, you know, the sort of most stereotypical Trump in the diner New York Times voter, right? Like the downscale white working class types that probably don't like DeWine that much, even, you know, because he got cucked a little bit on COVID and don't trust anybody, certainly any somebody from some other state calling them on the phone to tell them what they really think. And so that, and if you look at where the polls have missed over the past couple cycles, it has been mostly these kind of white working class in the upper Midwest, but even kind of in Maine with Collins. And you know, you've seen this in places like that more than in other places. So probably not right in the sense that Vance is probably leading Ryan. That's closer. But to your point, even if you unskew the polls a little bit, like, the gap is pretty significant. And to me, the telling thing, if the MAGA nationalist theory of the case was true, right, that there's this big appetite for Vance, Hawley, Masters, you know, nationalism that, like, doesn't have Trump's, like, skill at the trolling stuff, but is more, you know, the types of, you know, nerds who sit in conference rooms at Claremont and try to put some ideology around Trumpism and, you know, some sheen of seriousness around nationalist populism and are putting forth these candidates, you know, funded by Peter Thiel. You would think that there would be some voters that would cut the other way, right? That that group could be able to reach into, you know, some of your Reagan Democrat types who maybe don't like DeWine, right? And there's not like any evidence of the fact that that is happening. Masters is running way behind where Lake is, for example. Vance running way behind. So the encouraging thing for me about this is, even if Vance squeaks out a victory, it is not exactly a bullish sign for the scariest vertical inside our politics, which is these, you know, this new right.
Let me twist the knife a little bit here.
Okay, great.
I think if Josh Mandel had been the nominee, he'd be 5 points ahead of wherever Vance is right now.
Right.
The Republican institutions, which went to the mattresses to try to muscle J.D. Vance through. The truth is, he's such a bad candidate and such a mope that, you know, and his campaign has been horrendous. I mean, he's barely there. He's like gallivanting around Europe and going on pilgrimages.
People can smell it too. He's got the little beard, and he feels like the beardy dude that walked into the VC firm in California and like wanted to be a fake Midwestern Svengali. Like he feels like what he is, right? Yeah. Which is like not a real advocate for like working class industrial Ohioans, right? People can smell that shit, and Mandel is kind of phony, but it was a phony
was
in
a
like try more
hard.
Typical.
He was a phony.
Yeah, it was
try
like
hard.
A more typical yeah. Republican way.
Yeah.
Well, like the way Lake is, right? Like Lake is also a phony.
Yeah.
But she's like Mandel phony. We're like they're really committed to it,
super
right?
And Will and, like, Ferrell level of commitment.
That's right. And so, like, if you go back and you know, if you really dig them up See, 8 years
I'm
ago,
I'm sorry. Hold on, Sacha Baron Cohen. Levels of commitment. Like they are living the character, right? Right? Joaquin Phoenix yeah. levels. Yeah. They're going on Letterman in character.
Like, and they, to the point where like they believe it now themselves to some degree, where like J.D. Vance and all these other soft boys that are running as the sort of nationalist populist types, these are different shades of something that are not the same. So on one hand, right, what works is when you run as sort of the multi-ethnic, multi-racial working class coalition. Right. And this is something that I think like Marco Rubio has sort of at least understood, like, okay, this is what we're going for. And like, sometimes we're going to side with the unions against big corporations because the corporations are woke and that's different from independent businesses, which we still support. That's different from sort of the nationalist populist thing that Masters and Hawley and those guys are doing, where it's like a war on big tech and war, but it's all very performative and it's all kind of from Yale and people like that doesn't connect with the working class ethos. They hear it. They're like, yeah, you're right about the woke stuff. And I don't agree with that, but it doesn't hit people the same way. And it's why it's hard for Vance is because Ryan does have that multi-ethnic, multi-racial working class ability to connect. And like, that's why he's kind of eaten into the Trump margins. Trump was able to connect with that multi-racial working class, thing, not because he was exactly like that, but even though he was very rich, but he still and had soft hands, but he was still somebody that they saw as kind of like them because he was very accessible in the way that he talked and like
he was very famous.
Yeah,
he was very famous.
Tabloidy is WWE, and he is very famous, right? But JD is more of the put a finer point of it. It's like the severely conservative Mitt Romney moment at CPAC, but like, he's like, I'm severely populist. You know, it's like you can just sense that he whiffs on it when he's like, I to be honest with you, Steve, I don't care what happens with the Ukrainians. I don't give a fuck what happens with the Ukrainians. Like working the people who are listening to that are kind of like, I don't know. I was with you on the fact that like we shouldn't be fighting wars over there on behalf of the globalists, but like I don't care about the Ukrainians is like a little try hard, right? Like we do care about the Ukrainians. We don't like the Russians. We don't like the woke military, right? It's like you're sort of trying to hit it, but you're trying a little too hard and veering off the edge, and people just can smell
it. It's not an accident that all of these big populist tough guys are like Curtis Yarvin, J.D. Vance, right? I mean, they're like the most effete, whatever. Okay. Into Pennsylvania. So this is the other interesting piece of polling that I wanted to talk about. Charlie highlighted this in his outstanding newsletter, which is free every day with no ads in it or anything. Everybody should go to thebulwark.com and sign up for Charlie's newsletter. there is this huge likability gap in Pennsylvania. And the bigger one is between Doug Mastriano and Josh Shapiro. Mastriano's at about negative 24 net likability, Shapiro plus 12.
That's, is that bad?
I think it's not great, Bob.
It's about the same as yours, Tim. It's like right the same. Yeah.
Negative 24. I've been creeping up, okay? I've been creeping up.
And with Fetterman Oz also, sorry, at negative 24. And what's funny here is that Mastriano has spent $0 on television and Oz has spent like an entire vitamin shop's worth of dollars on television. And what he's been able to do though is drive Fetterman down to only plus three. But so here you have, in terms of likability, enormous high 20s to mid 30s advantages for the Democrats. But in the actual polling, advantages which are only like plus five to plus nine. Sarah, you know a lot about this stuff. Doesn't likability normally track a lot closer with how people wind up voting? Don't people normally vote for like the person they like? And like they then construct all their rationales after the fact?
I mean, I think that we're going to feel that way because, I mean, I think the answer is sort of yes. And I think both these guys, I mean, I would say, I think they're going to win. I think that the Fetterman-Oz race is going to be closer than people expect, but I still think Fetterman's going to pull it out. But this is what I mean about people coming home. Like, I think what's happening with Oz is people don't like him. And just one other just factor that happened is a bunch of the Republicans ran really sort of devastating primaries against each other. And so like in the Pennsylvania primary and in the Ohio primary, you had this, right, where they were just destroying each other. They spent millions of dollars of ads driving negatives up on each other in the Republican primaries, and the Democrats in these cases mostly just kind of walked in.
You're making an argument for Joe Biden to run for re-election, by the
way. That's not. I'm not.
Primaries are not good for the party if you can avoid them.
Well, it depends. It depends on whether you're trying to sort of like reinvigorate a new generation and have a big conversation. I just think there are times when you have the advantage of incumbency that can be problematic. Whether or not that's true for Joe Biden is a different story. But it hurt these Republicans. And so that's part of the reason their favorabilities are so low. But also like people are going to come home. Republicans are going to like hold their nose and vote for Oz, a lot of them. And especially even these college-educated suburban ones that normally you see as being willing to vote for the Democrats against like in like a Blake Masters case or something, they might vote for Oz. It's the like white working class Trump voters that actually probably pull Fetterman over the edge.
You know who's one of these voters you're talking about, JVL, seems like? I don't want to speak for them. I can't get in this person's head per se, but based on an article I read this weekend.
Tell me.
The great Selena Zito.
Ooh.
The Washington Examiner, Pittsburgh Post-Tribune. Yeah, she's taking a lot of heat for being a very Trumpy, maybe not personally, but her writing was very, you know, sort of representing the Trump voter. Was early on this, kind of seeing that this was happening in the Republican primary from Pennsylvania, seeing the type of voter they're, you know, living in her community. And she wrote basically a brutal takedown on Mastriano, how unlikable he is.
That's because she doesn't get any access from him. This is
maybe.
No, not okay, maybe. I'm just telling you, I know Selena a little bit.
But like, isn't that doesn't that tell you something though?
It tells me that they think that they all think that he's going to lose. And so they think there's no price for crapping on him.
Fair enough. But I guess what I'm saying is if she's writing this article, it's like Josh Shapiro, actually kind of a likable guy, cares about Pennsylvania, going around and meeting folks. On the other hand, Doug Mastriano, really weird, kind of creepy, doesn't let any media be around him, don't really understand what is happening there. Are there not then voters who sort of are getting that same impression, who are probably Trump-supporting voters? Some of them might hold their nose and vote for Mastriano anyway, and some of them might just be like, I don't know, this guy is just too weird and creepy, and Josh Shapiro seems perfectly fine, right? And so I think what I'm trying to get at is that to some extent explains that gap too, where you have these people that they might not necessarily like Mastriano, but you know, they're still partisan brainwormed, partisan pilled, and like they're not going to go vote for Josh Shapiro, like a Jewish Democrat.
How could you? Yeah. All right, so let's move on. There's two things that our buddy Sebastian pulled for us, and I found them so compelling that I wanted us to spend like a minute and a half on each of them. The first is a clip from, which we're not going to bother listening to, of Kyrsten Sinema giving a talk at the McConnell Center at the behest of her good friend, Mitch McConnell, who...
Did you know he had a center? I didn't know he had a center.
I did.
I just assumed. Yeah, you know, you spread that much money around your state for that long, eventually you get a center. And she, you know, Mitch McConnell praised her to the moon, and she just loved him right back. And I want to talk to Sarah about this, because in theory, this is the kind of thing that you and I both really want. Correct? We want...
I also would like to, Sarah, before you said correct, I also would like to talk to Sarah about this, because I'm interested in if she can get inside the mind of a queer, politically minded woman, because I don't understand what's happening in Kyrsten Sinema's mind. So I want to see Sarah's opinion, both from a strategic and a psychological
standpoint. I am a sucker for this sort of thing. I love the idea of having our politics back between the 40-yard lines, where what we're fighting about are marginal tax rates and pork, and, you know, is there waste and fraud in building this dam project or something? That's what I would like to spend my time worrying about. I would like to worry about, like, reforming higher education or immigration or stuff like that, and not worry about, like, democracy protection. And so one of the necessary conditions for that is that we need to get to a point where the people who actually have to do the work of governing have working relationships with one another. And some people see this as the swamp. Some people say this is all just BS kabuki theater. I place value in this, and I'd like to see it. On the other hand, McConnell's introduction of Sinema, as he was just slathering her up, he was talking about how she bravely stood to protect the filibuster. And here's what McConnell said. He said, if you break the institution, here meaning the filibuster, you break the country. Now, again, great deal of wisdom in that. I actually halfway agree with it. Sometimes I agree more than others. Sometimes I agree less than others. This is the same guy who broke the Supreme Court nomination process by refusing to hold a vote on a nominee for a sitting president. And then 4 years later, pushing through a nominee with no support to essentially fully rebalance the Supreme Court. He broke the country. He did that, Mitch McConnell. And now he's praising her for that. Sarah, you also like this sort of stuff, yes?
Yes.
Am I putting why you like it? A, in this specifically, you like this sort of thing in general. Do you like this specific thing with McConnell and Sinema? B, what is she getting out of any of this? Is she just getting to own the libs? Like, what? Because I sat there thinking to myself, does she win a single vote in Arizona by hanging out with Mitch McConnell? Because to the best of my knowledge, nobody in America likes Mitch McConnell.
Hmm.
The MAGAs hate him. The libs hate him. The other, you know, there are a few people in the federal society who really like Mitch McConnell because he's gotten them a bunch of justices seated.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it.
Sure. But he is an enormously powerful senator, right? And so let's just back up for a second. And people who may be listening to this for the first time don't know that there's an ongoing dynamic here in which you guys argued for a long time that nothing could ever get done in the Senate, that, you know, everything was going to be bad. Nobody was going to cooperate ever. And I said, that's not true. I kept saying I thought that there would be things that people would cooperate on that they could find 10 Republican votes for. And that has turned out to be true over and over and over again. So but JBL and I had this argument on the Secret Pod when she did that appearance with Cornyn. Remember, she appeared with Cornyn to talk about the filibuster. Mm. And it was a little bit similar, where it felt like she was the one being used as the political prop for the other side, right? And yet, I suspect that a lot of the backroom dealing, the like shadow Senate or the shadow Congress, involves the fact that Manchin and Sinema have these good relationships with Republicans. And I understand that there is a real desire to want to attack them over them not abolishing the filibuster. I am somebody who, you know, I am marginally for the filibuster. I'm up for some reforms, but I do not think we should scrap it. The reason that we have the Supreme Court that we do now is because we scrapped the filibuster for the court appointments, which was the both sides ratcheting up the scrapping of the filibuster over time so they could blame each other tit for tat. I think that it's good to have people try to get to 10 votes and work together and have there be something remotely bipartisan about it. So what does she get out of it? I suspect she is at the center of a lot of deal brokering in the actual Senate, which is good.
So that's it? She just wants to be in the center of the thing? I just don't understand. Like, what does she want to get out of the deals? Like the whole, and she
the deals,
like
the
what? Deals. So she just likes doing deals. Like that's it. She just likes doing.
Like at the well, end you say of the deals. You say the deals as though there's. I mean, if she sees them as substantively improving people's lives.
I mean, her thing for the Inflation Reduction Act was like the carried interest tax.
Right,
break.
The carried interest. So
who wanted and look, that? Her and like 8 hedge fund dudes.
Maybe she just it was a sop to some hedge fund people that she knows. Maybe it was a deal she brokered with the Republicans for their donors. I have no idea why she did it, but
4-dimensional chess.
Maybe
where she made a demand for the Republicans that the Democrats would have to accommodate.
I'm just not going
to
engage in performative cinema bashing just because it's like what?
Who's neither of us are doing that.
I'm not saying you guys are doing it. I'm saying Twitter does it. I'm not saying you guys are doing it. I'm saying like it in the world right now, right? It is like a very popular thing to just like Kristen Sinema is inexplicable and I hate her and she should get primaried and like that well, tends.
Can I just offer the substantive case for the fact that she's inexplicable and that she should get primaried?
Sure.
Is that she's inexplicable and she should get primaried? What? Nobody follows this closer than me. Okay. Nobody spends more time reading Twitter. I listen to lobbyist podcasts. Like I engage into this as closely as anyone. And I have no idea what it is that she wants. Like, I guess besides, like you're saying, besides to be in the mix, to be the person doing the deals. But like John McCain, when he was being mavericky, had like a base of people like me, moderate, squishy Republicans who were like also thought the climate change was real and that we should be nicer to immigrants and that we shouldn't torture people, but that are conservative on other issues. Like when John McCain was being a mavericky, that was him. He wasn't always perfect. Sometimes he was inscrutable. Sometimes he was, you know, easily flattered or whatever and would do some inside game stuff. It's not like he's perfect. I don't know. What is Kristen Sinema's ideology? Is she a center-left liberal? Is she a far-left liberal? Is she a populist liberal? Like, is she a corporate liberal? I guess she's a corporate liberal now. She's like, she just loves, like, big corporations and wants to, like, think that they can get jobs. Like, does she just like Mitch McConnell's thing? I don't understand. It's inscrutable. Joe Manchin it is with her on all this stuff, and it's very understandable why Joe Manchin is pushing for what he is doing. He's pushing for, he doesn't want the coal industry in his state to get screwed. He wants to be a little more open to culture, the cultural right, the working class, because he lives in fucking West Virginia where the entire state is MAGA Republicans. Like, I understand exactly why he's doing and what he's doing. I don't understand what she's doing. I should be her base, right? I'm a moderate centrist. Like, throw me a thing. Be like, hey, the libs have gone overboard on this student loan thing or something. Here are a few substantive things where the left has gone overboard. And I want to, like, that's not what she's done. She's just, like, being weird.
She is pretty weird. I mean, here's the thing. Look, she doesn't talk to anybody. And so when I say inscrutable, she is genuinely inscrutable. Like, nobody knows what it is that she's doing. But I think there's, like, a charitable case you could make where she's watching politics break down. She's watching people hate each other. And she's decided that one of the things she's going to do is lean into demonstrating that you can have these kinds of relationships. And I do think, like, she is still voting for all of Biden's stuff. She is, like, she had this one weird thing where she dug in over the carried interest on that. And I couldn't even tell at that point if, like, she just wanted her pound of flesh because she'd done a lot of work on it. I mean, Manchin got a bunch of stuff too. The whole thing got reduced. Like, she votes for all the judges. Like, she votes for most of the Biden, you know, agenda. Maybe she likes being liked by her colleagues. And
is she liked by her Democratic colleagues?
I have no idea.
I don't get that sense. Maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong. I don't know. I mean, I look at this and my I would say for any person who has ever been in the United States Senate, if they're ever doing something that doesn't make sense, the Occam's razor explanation is because they want to run for president someday. And so I just assume that one of the things about Sinema is maybe she wants to run for president someday. Maybe that's not the case. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. But
Occam's razor isn't always right.
I think one of the reasons that people find her so perplexing is because she was like a green progressive.
Member of the Green Party.
And so like she's had a long journey. I don't know. Maybe she got there and said like, I don't know. I've looked around this institution. And what I think it needs more than anything else is like us to have conversations with each other and prove that we can be decent to each other.
I just think it's a weird place to be in the Democrats when you're getting flanked on the left by Bill Kristol. You know, it's like, it just might be a moment. It just might be a moment to be like, what's happening right now? Anyway, okay, fair enough.
No, but Tim, do you think you should get rid of the filibuster? Do you think we should get, JVL and I talked about this today.
I don't think that we should get rid of the, I think that it's really stupid that Democrats want to get rid of the filibuster, actually.
Okay, but that's her main thing. That's the main thing she's stood up on.
Yeah, okay. So I guess we agree on that, but it's sort of like, The manner in which she makes that argument is very odd, I think. And again, to JVL's point, it's like, oh, I need to respect the institution, and so now I'm here with Mitch McConnell,
the great
and
respecter people that stormed of institutions, the Capitol,
and like all of my criticism is about the left. You know, it's okay. It's just like, why is all every time I see her talking, is she criticizing the left only? Like after we've had a storming of the Capitol. I find that to be strange. I agree with her on the filibuster. If I was her and I was a liberal, which she may not be anymore, I don't know, who wanted to protect the filibuster, the argument that I would be making is I'm deeply scared that President Ron DeSantis in 2024 is going to ban abortion at 1 week federally. And she has said that. That has been one of her points, but it doesn't seem like her main point, right? And so like that is what I think the left could really use somebody out there making that argument, which is, aren't you guys concerned about this? Aren't you guys like worried that getting rid of the filibuster could have some very extreme consequences? Like look at the laws that are being passed in some of these red states around trans issues, around, you know, all these other social issues. Doesn't that worry you? Maybe we should have a check on this. I think that's a compelling argument.
Yeah. And again, I have no idea what goes on in Kristen Sinema heads. And the fact that she's, although did you see, I guess she used to date Keith Olbermann. He'd throw that on Twitter. Yeah, very, that was a weird, it's a weird little thing to find out. Who dates?
Isn't he like 30 years older than she?
Yeah. So like who dates Keith Olbermann and is a green, queer, like communist type in tutus who then becomes a senator and hangs out with Mitch McConnell? Like, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
Bisexuals. They just can't make up their mind.
That's true. Can't make up. But so like, I have no idea why she is the way she is. All I know is that there's there are 50-ish other senators that I more than that. Cause I would put some of like the Maisie Hirono is like the really like way before her. Like I find the obsession with Sinema and even the hatred for like a Susan Cotton. Like I agree obviously with what you said that like, basically I think everybody should focus on the people who did the coup, that's really important. That being said, I am sympathetic to being a legislator in a swing state who is looking around saying like, boy, politics is really toxic. Like and who decides, like maybe it wouldn't be our decision, but who decides that the best thing she can do in her role, maybe because she's a people person or she's an institutionalist, I don't know. She's like, I can be friends with these guys and I can try to bring the temperature down. Nobody likes it. I'll stipulate that. Nobody is a fan of this thing. That's my charitable case for Kyrsten Sinema.
Someone had to make it.
All right. Well, I mean, look, Joe Biden's been bringing the temperature down. God love him. Nobody gives him credit for that either. All right. Sorry, I had to stand for Biden here. Listen, we had a bunch of other stuff we were going to talk about, but the show is already running long.
Is it?
And
it's always running
long. I don't want to cheat. We're not there yet, but we're going to be long. I will have to cheat people out of furry talk. And so I am going to fast forward us right to that. Sarah, you just did a focus group about furries. I'm Ron Burgundy.
Okay. No. JVL. Of course, that's not what happened.
Okay.
But this was funny, although Twitter is making me so mad. Because nothing's funny anymore. This is just what I mean. Maybe Kyrsten Sinema just got like so fed up with everybody and has just like decided to just one epic troll after another.
Cancel culture run amok.
Run amok. So I'm doing this focus group with Wisconsin swing voters, and it's a terrific group. They are thoughtful. They voted for Trump in 16, all the reasons I always say, hated Hillary Clinton. He was a businessman, maybe do something different. Saw him over the 4 years and were like, absolutely not again in 2020. And we're very much sticking with it. But they all voted in the Republican primary, which was pretty interesting. And most of them had voted for governor for Clefish, who was the slightly more establishment type over this guy.
I'm sorry, just for clarity, the Republican primary in 2022.
In 2022, last round, they voted in the Republican primary. And so that's how they're thinking about themselves, right? Like they were Republicans, they voted for Trump, then they voted for Biden, but they're still voting in Republican primaries. And they all tried to basically vote for like the more normal of the two Republicans. They hate Ron Johnson, but just out of nowhere. So they, you know, they're just talking and I'm just listening. It was done the other night and I was just catching up. I couldn't watch it live. And so I was watching the recording and I was listening. And all of a sudden this woman, she's like, you know, she's talking about just how the country is falling apart. Mm. And she just says, you know, and I'm a teacher and I was at the school the other day for this event. And there were like 12 or 15 kids who are dressed as furries. And like, there's sort of this like record scratch in the group. And like, some people are like, what do you mean furries? Like, and this group is just like all like middle-aged people. And so like,
Lutheran, Wisconsinites, mild-mannered, you know, not a lot of cursing, dagnamit.
Sarah, I'm sorry. I'm gonna require you to do the entire rest of this story in the Wisconsin accent.
I can't do it. And she's like, but her point was like, this is the problem with Trump, is that once you just like, anybody can say whatever they want, anybody can do whatever they want, bing, bang, boom, furry. You got kids acting like furries. But so then some of the people in the group are like, what's a furry? And the moderator too is like, is that when you dress up as a stuffed animal? Which I thought was like, my understanding of furries is pretty limited. I just think it's always been like a funny thing. Something people say about Beto, like Beto's a furry. I don't know. So this woman says like, yes, I had to explain this to my like, you know, 90-year-old mother recently. She's like, I told her that this monkeypox thing is real. And I told her that about furries. And so she defines it for the group.
She was trying to kill her 90-year-old mother.
Yeah, she said her mother had a tough time, you know, coming to grips with this. But she said that that furries is when you identify as like a dog or a cat.
That's not correct.
Which I was pretty sure wasn't right. That's it.
Incorrect.
And incorrect. So the group is really funny because the group is reacting two ways. There are like old men being like, they identify as cats and dogs? Like one old guy is saying that. Very nice guy. And they're just shaking their heads like, this is, the world has gone crazy. And then there's other people that are sort of like, so there's like the people that are like disbelief, but like, whatever. And then there's the other part of the group that's like, yeah, this is a real thing. I know about this. I've heard about this. And I was laughing. I was crying with laughter, but then I tweeted about it.
Before we get to the Twitter drama,
yeah.
There was not a single member, including the moderator. The moderator just not want to be Candy Crowley. There was not a single member of the group who correctly defined the furry.
I don't think so. I don't think anybody had like
because it's a sexual thing. It's not a gender identity thing. Right?
That's right.
It's like you get off on fucking mascots.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Thank you, JBL.
Yeah. So I'm sorry.
Right. Is that
no,
wrong?
No. Thank you for summing it up. I was going to give a much more deliberative explanation than that, for some of our listeners to work them in, but no, you get off on fucking mascots.
Oh, that's Sebastian exactly put right. it in the yeah. comments. His
definition is also a little softer. JVL really got
an enthusiast for animal characters with human characteristics, in particular, a person who dresses up in a costume as such a character and uses one as an avatar online. Oh, that is also softer because my understanding.
Then they meet in public. They're meetings, they're furry meetups, and you know you'll have like a Care Bear and, you know, whatever, Woody the Woodpecker. and they get together, and you know they
and the Philly fanatic, yeah. There's with that tongue
there's
of
some
his.
Flirting happening, and right. I've never really quite understood
nothing for the Philly fanatic.
I was letting it go. I've never really quite understood like the particulars of the orgasm and how that goes down, because I think there's some challenges for the males in particular. I think there's some challenges there that I never really understood, but besides that, I'm pretty well versed. I just the end game, I don't know the details on. Sebastian does, but he said he was going to share it offline. So
okay, so I just because I think I saw a documentary or something like on MTV when we were like all in our early 20s or something. This was a thing, and that's like the last time I ever like clocked this phenomenon. And of course, at the time, it was just like, all right, like this is goofy, but whatever. This isn't like a real thing. Like it's not like a lot of people do this, and if they do, and people want to get dressed up as animals and like. I don't know.
God bless them.
Hang Your out. Lord. Like, whatever. It just, like, seems, like, relatively harmless compared to many other things one could be doing.
I mean, you know, why don't they dress up as Confederate soldiers and go out and do militia work? That would be wholesome. It's terrible that they're dressing up as Elmo to bang it out together. They should be out marching with armbands and AKs. And
tri-cornered hats.
AR-15.
Muskets.
That's
not why
America.
This is funny. But that's not why this is funny. This is funny because while they're having furry panic on this thing, right? And she's explaining it, like she's explaining it wrong. And so like the people in the group, so it's like, it's about identifying as cats and dogs, which I think is a newer phenomenon that, as Tim points out, is related to what is sort of the panic over the current gender identity that's going on, right? It's sort of like queer.
It's not a new phenomenon. It's like a series of Facebook memes that old people are reading and thinking are true.
Well, so, I mean, I'm sure that there were like kids at this school who like had, I don't know, like cat's ears on or like. Yeah.
That's a thing something. They make for girls now. They have headbands with little cat's ears on them. It doesn't mean that these kids are walking around saying, I demand that you address me as you know, Miss Peebles or something.
Yeah, or they were in like footy pajamas being like teenagers. Like, this is the thing. This is where moral panic meets like kids
gullible
being
old people.
Well, like kids being weirdos just to do it because, you know, they're teenagers. Like, they put on trench coats. They were goths. They were whatever. Everybody.
Can we get this woman on, though? Like, I have some follow-up questions. Like, what were the pronouns for the cat kids? Like, were they demanding to be called, like, you know, kitty?
She clearly had just, like, seen it. Like, this was... But then somebody else did chime in with this other
thing. I don't think she did. I bet you anything she didn't see. I bet you she read something on Facebook.
No. This was... She had a very clear story. I'm not going to... Because I don't want to like put a place around it, right? But she had a very clear story about a place she was and a thing that she witnessed. So I'm not.
She was
gonna...
in Crucial, Waukesha County. And
this person is totally normal. She is not. You do not need to disparage her. She's telling you a thing that she saw. She's just somebody who gets caught up, right, in this, like, because there is this sort of panic about gender identity right now, and there's all these things, and like kids are identifying as strawberries and like everything, you know, because like kids are just being weird. People use that as a way to be like, boy, whole country is falling apart. And I'm like, guys, teenagers have always been weird, and like older people have always been mystified by young people. Like, that's all that's happening
this
here.
This is literally the Satanism
this
panic.
This is not
with
the end of
Do you
society.
Remember that?
But oh, yeah. I thought it was just funny. Like, I just thought it was like pure joy, funny.
And the people on Twitter shared in your mirth?
No, everybody like immediately decamped into like, oh, and that's Biden's fault. And I was like, no. Like, actually, she was blaming Trump, but like, it's neither of their faults that, like, for generations, kids have been weird and adults have been mystified by their like practices. This is just funny. Like, why
then
can't anybody just
the other category of Twitter complaints?
Oh, and then, yeah, but then there's the other category who's like, see, this is how like genderqueer theory is destroying America. I'm like, guys, none of this is everybody settle down.
Did you have anybody from the left chastising you for not taking the furries' concerns seriously?
Well, I did. There were people in there, yeah, being like, I've met furries and they're very nice people. And I'm like, okay, well, this isn't. I'm not disparaging furries. I'm not disparaging this is just funny, guys. And why can't this was? It was meant to be a timeline cleanser. And instead, everybody takes everything so seriously, and everyone should stop it.
You can't have timeline cleansers these days, Sarah. Okay, I just, please, just focus on the enemy. All right, tweeting about the enemy and why they are always bad. That's the only thing that's acceptable.
Good show. Long show, very long show. First show out from behind the paywall. It was something else.
I think we could have gone longer. I had a lot of good material. I had good material about Glenn Youngkin and the student walkout. I had good material on Gavin Newsom and how creepy he was.
Why don't we cut the January 6th thing and talk about Gavin Newsom?
Because we're not going to do that, Sarah. We'll do Gavin Newsom next week. Gavin Newsom isn't going away. He's so thirsty. He's going to be there being thirsty in our faces for until Joe Biden, like, you know, actually declares that he's running for re-election.
And even after.
Yeah. So, all right. Everybody's just joining us for the first time. Thanks so much. Go ahead and subscribe. Mash that subscribe button.
Tell your pals.
Tell your pals. Go to thebulwark.com. Follow Tim on Twitter. Follow Sarah on Twitter. Sign up for Charlie's newsletters at thebulwark.com. Read all of our great stuff. Listen to the podcast. Follow the videos. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Peace.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.